We really try to give people the full view, and we had to learn a lot of things the hard way. When people work with us, what they're really getting is the education we bring with it, so they truly have peace of mind and way less work.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I'm your host, Justin Dixon. Today, I've got a husband and wife dynamic duo, Dan and Rena. They are the founders of Boutique. They are a real estate investment platform for short-term rental investors. They help these deals. They help you underwrite them. And then once you actually acquire the business, they actually help you to manage it and get as much of return as possible. So we dive into their how they got started in real estate with one condo and then backed into this boutique business. We talk about being a husband and wife team and how that dynamic works both in their personal life and their professional life. And we dig into all this stuff. So let's welcome Rena and Dan to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Justin.
Awesome. Well, let's kick things off here. Maybe if you could give just a little bit of an intro on who you guys are and a little bit of your story, and then we'll unpack some stuff.
Perfect. So I'll start. I'm Rena and this is Dan. And I like to joke that we have built-in co-working because we are married and we work together. So we are partners in life and in business. And when it comes to business, we are co-founders of a company called Boutique. And so we're creating a traveler brand for high-quality vacation rentals and a real estate investment engine. So we want to be the best place to travel, but also the best place to put your money when you're looking to invest in this asset class.
Got it. I'm curious a little bit about how your journey into this world started. Like, did you get involved in real estate investing in other asset classes and then think about boutique, or like, how did that evolution happen?
Yeah, I would say we really backed into real estate as an investment class that we could even participate in. I think the first hurdle was owning a primary residence. And so we live in Austin. We had purchased a condo many, many years ago. It was very affordable. And basically, that was our handhold into the world, was actually owning real estate. So that was major. And that made it feel like instead of paying every month into that black hole of rent, we were actually going to be able to benefit from equity over time, appreciation. And so when we purchased another property, we were like, well, we'd like to keep the condo. I mean, right. It's a great asset. We think it's going to appreciate, but how do we afford the mortgage? I was going to business school at the time. And so we're like, what about short-term renting? Could we put it up and cover maybe part of the mortgage? And that's how Boutique started, is we were essentially just trying to see as a household, how could we allow ourselves to keep this valuable asset when there's a mortgage every month? And so for us, the short-term rentals was our opportunity to actually keep something that we had purchased. And we found that we loved it and we were actually very good at it. And so we started to see that as an opportunity, but it wasn't one that we had necessarily even been thinking of before. It was like, it was presented opportunistically. And then we found out like, wow, this is amazing. And I wish that everyone could access something like this.
Right. No, that's interesting. And how did that first condo short-term rental, how did it perform? And then where did the start of Boutique, because obviously going in from having one short-term rental to having others and building a platform, and obviously we'll dig into that here in a second, but how did that first one perform? And then how did it spawn into Boutique?
Yeah, I mean, originally it was just a curiosity, as Rena said, but we started to discover, one, we really kind of liked the experience of interacting with people and trying to, frankly, just exceed expectations. Sometimes that can just personally be quite gratifying. And we started to realize that if you didn't take an antagonistic or adversarial point of view with your guest as the host, but rather truly were their host and you look forward to having them stay with you and you lean in on that experience, it turns out that is also worth a lot more and that the reviews are worth a lot of peace of mind. And we just started to realize that just instinctively, maybe we were a little bit better than the medium, and then started just to nerd out a little bit on this. And there's a lot of data that was flowing around, but it wasn't very organized. There weren't that many tools for pricing or anything like that. So Marina and I've always had this, never mind, we'll do it ourselves approach to things. So we built our own scraper and then an algorithm with the data that created, and just found a way to price our Airbnb way more effectively and automagically, so to speak, than other tools that were starting to emerge, that this just kept working. And so we realized there was an opportunity to really lean in and apply data science to that, and eventually shared what we were doing with our friend Tim. And we built a machine learning version of the original heuristic algorithm. And that also allowed us to start to understand where to buy, from an investor standpoint, homes that would frankly earn the best cap rates based on purchase price and likely future revenue in the near term. And so we just started to realize that there was both an opportunity to do this for ourselves as a personal side hustle, passive income stream potentially, although it never really is that passive in the way that people think, which is part of why we found out there was a business here. Is like, if it needs to be passive, you probably have to like hand this off to some people who are truly experts, both in the search and discovery phase, the setup phase, but also the ongoing operations. We like to joke that we have a PhD in finding Cheerios under the rug, because there's so many random edge cases, but if you do this at scale, they're not edge cases. And at the same time, it's the edge cases that typically kill your reputation. So you really have to be sophisticated and eager to make sure they check out with a big smile on their face.
So it sounds like you've got a lot of tech in this business, I guess. What are your backgrounds professionally? Rena, it sounds like you were going to business school at the time. Are you developer? Like, Diane, are you a developer? Like, what's your core background?
First. So my background is, I actually went to undergrad for international politics at Georgetown. So I was studying very different, although you're two semesters away from an econ major. So you have to actually have a lot of economics background in that. But I did a public policy degree. So quantitative methods, statistics, accounting, all of that. And then MBA, which is those things, but applied to a private sector client. And so I am not a developer, but I've always honestly been good at and been fascinated by math, data science, and that I think serves me well within boutique.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, my background was policy in undergrad, but really was interested in using data to make decisions and not just anecdotal hunches. One of the things that we've discovered early on is a lot of common sense. Not only isn't common, but also commonly held beliefs are often wrong. And so leading with data and coming in with an open mind when you look at it often surprises you. So we discovered early on that, for example, urban markets, small, cheap property acquisitions were actually not a good deal. Not only are the rates you earn not as good, but there's way more sophisticated competition, whereas a lot of markets where there's a perception that seasonality is limited and you can't earn that much, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that people just really underestimate these markets. And so right now, there are lots of articles being written about, is this a good time or a bad time to invest?
Yeah,
we've kind of been saying from the beginning that if you trust the data and you stop just going with your gut instincts, you may actually have found that this is a great time to invest. And the decisions to invest previously were good because you were targeting markets that weren't, frankly, in a bubble. And then other markets that looked really good during the pandemic have started to fizzle. But these were markets and properties that we always thought would struggle in the long run. So I think what we both had was a curiosity for using data to make informed decisions.
Yeah.
Both of us have business degrees, but we're also just people who read a lot, are always mining articles for data, or in many cases, you read an article and you're scratching your head. It's like, how is this in a major publication? And there's very little data. So you start looking for it yourself or creating it yourself.
Yeah.
There is a lot of public data. The internet is a pretty interesting beast that can be used.
I'll distill that just real quickly, because our experience has been, let's try to use data rather than emotion. Because I think especially when it comes to real estate, like when it's your residence or even when you're buying it as an investment, you're like, ooh, but I want to visit it. And I'm like, I want
to. Well, right. So especially beautiful. The short-term space, right? You're like, oh, I want to go to Hawaii as opposed to going to Ozark, Missouri.
That's it. Exactly. So it's like, you have to take your personal preferences or imagining that you are necessarily the traveler, the client, the renter, et cetera.
Right.
You have to kind of take that away. And I know that for us, the first moment that that happened is when we were making a purchase fully for it to be an investment property. Like we would ancillary go and visit, but we're like, okay, this is going to be an investment decision. We're like, okay, for our budget, we could buy two smaller properties. And then we're looking, okay, this is how they do. And intellectually, people say, oh, yeah, that's less risky. lower price point, diversification. And then we were like, well, if we actually went up market, these are the returns that we're seeing. And so even though you might be inclined to hedge your bets and say, I'm going to feel like I don't want to take as big of a risk, I'm going to go lower because that's what my emotion is telling me. That's what the man on the street would say. We are just going to make a data-based decision rather than letting it be informed by emotion. So we did that and it proved itself correct. And we just keep doing that. And I think that's kind of a true line in our story.
We also were convinced that most people, even in the market that we looked at, we never heard of this town when we found the property we wanted to invest in. A lot of people weren't doing it to the full value that they could. The means were not delivering better ends. And we were just like, if you really lean in and make the experience great, there's way more juice to squeeze. And at the same time, it got to the point that if we wanted to stay there routinely, we would actually rent a house down the street because the arbitrage was such that we could make way more money renting our property.
Rent somebody else's.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, real estate's hard to get the emotion out. I remember when my wife and I were looking for our first investment property. It was like, oh, I wouldn't want to live here. It's like, well, I'm not the renter.
Have that be the calculus.
It can actually be great because then it means that you can go travel and take all the trips you want and know that this is passively funding your vacation in the background. You didn't take it off the grid.
Yeah, you don't feel the opportunity cost of like not sitting there.
No, that makes sense. I want to dig into boutique a little bit more and how it's gone from one condo to where it is now. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. We'll be right back.
Whether you're trying to hire a full-time employee or a contractor to fill a gap, Hire Tomorrow can help. Hire Tomorrow is a boutique recruitment firm that has successfully filled sales and marketing, human resources, and technology positions with companies ranging from startups to Fortune 500. If you're struggling to find the right talent, check out HireTomorrow.com or reach out to recruiting@HireTomorrow.com. to see how they can help.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. So before the break, we got your origin story, your backgrounds on your short-term rental journey. You built this business boutique. So I guess, where's the business now? Obviously, it started with a condo and you backed into, hey, this could be a business that we could start. So I'm curious where you are now. First of all, when did it start? And then we're recording this in late June 2023. So where are you present day?
Yeah. So we formally incorporated in December of 2019. And we went through the Techstars Accelerator here in Austin. Oh, nice. And our demo day was March of 2020, which was an amazing time to bring new ideas into the world. Yeah. I was also pregnant. So I was 8 months pregnant. So we had our son a month later. But that's when boutique got started. That's when we really took that leap of faith and calculated risk of, let's take this from a side project where we had done it ourselves on multiple properties. And people were asking us, we're like, there is a business here. And from there, we grew the team, developed out the technology and our perspective on how we want to exist in the world. Like, what is the structure, OpCo, PropCo, et cetera. And from there, it was beginning with a single property that was not owned by us. Now we're at 50 million in assets under management, which is really exciting. It's about 30 different properties all over the US. And I think that's a real testament to one of our strengths, is our ability to do this across the US in diverse markets. So we're in 15 different markets and growing. And so we're able to have these high quality short-term rental operations across the US. And so from a traveler perspective, it's really exciting that you could stay with us when you go skiing, and then you can stay with boutique when you go to the beach. But from an investor perspective, it's pretty compelling because, hey, I don't have to be limited by, you know what, they just operate in South Florida, or they're just an Arizona shop, that we can say, all right, we're seeing compelling cap rates or whatever the metric of success is for an investor. We're seeing these opportunities in this location. Let's get a home there and set up that whole process. And then from there, it's about professional designers, et cetera. And then our machine learning pricing and high quality operations. And I would say that combination, it's that art and science where it's the high quality standard, these beautiful homes, our hospitality combined with putting homes in the right locations, knowing where to buy, and then the pricing that creates at the end of the day, our perspective is best traveler experience and best investor returns. And so it's really, I would say, gratifying to grow as much as we have, but we're not done yet. Like, we want to emerge as one of the dominant brands in travel and the one of the preferred choices for real estate investors. And so we've got big goals, and I would say we're like a scrappy, dynamic, ambitious team. So we've done quite a bit already, but to be honest, we are just getting started.
Yeah. So if I'm an investor, so you started out, you built this because you did it yourself. You did it with your own properties, proof of concept, right? Feel it out. And now you're shifting and you're helping investors find deals, underwrite them based on your metrics, and then you manage the properties, right? Or you make it as passive as possible for that investor.
Totally vertically integrated. Like, we'll help find it, set it up, and operate it. So it can be truly passive for the real estate investor. Exactly.
Got it. So if somebody's listening to this and like, oh, I've got $100,000 to $200,000 and like, hey, I want to get in the short-term rental space, but it's like boiling the ocean, right? You could be like, well, I want to go and ski. I want to go to the beach. What's the best spot? So you would actually help them to take the emotion out, right? Because that's probably part of the journey, especially with short-term rentals, if you want to use it partially as a destination vacation getaway. So maybe walk somebody through like, hey, if I have $250,000 and I want to invest and buy, and also maybe explain a little bit about the types of properties that fit into the boutique brand, because I'm assuming you don't just take every type of property that's out there.
Yeah, I'll start with that and then I'll let Dan share more about the journey for someone who wants to be an investor. That yes, we say no more than we say yes, because you have to have a mindset on quality if you're building this brand, but also if you want the returns that we are able to generate, right? So you can't just say yes to any home that'll have you, any investor that'll have you. You really need to be more discerning. So we're looking for larger properties. We're just focused on leisure destinations and their single family residences. And so there are other people doing other things. And we think, for example, folks that are focused in like urban 1 to 2 bedroom apartment type hotelier space, that could be complimentary. So they could stay there when it's work or it's travel as a couple, whereas family, group travel, leisure destinations, they would stay at a boutique. Yeah. So that's the positioning on the homes.
Yeah. And sometimes people are surprised by how much you really need to get these homes off the ground. So sometimes 250 doesn't go that far. And if you come in on a home that is like, you're thinking 400 or 500, maybe 600,000, oftentimes the returns aren't that good on those homes. But if you can get up towards the 900 to 1.2 million, you can see really good returns, but that requires a lot more cash. So
right.
The other options are, we have been partnering with real estate funds, where being an LP in that gives you diversified risk in terms of the assets are across the country, but it also means that you're not carrying any debt to income hits by taking leverage in order to acquire the unit. That's usually carried by the fund. Similarly, we've even worked with some partners like Arrived Homes, or also known as arrived.com, where for less than 250, as in $250, you can start owning shares in these homes. But the
goal has
really been the mission is, we aren't trying to just like build a luxury brand. Actually, like Rena's really makes clear, is like, our mission is to make sure that anybody who has the good judgment to start putting even small amounts of money, even if you're a college kid and you're just putting your pizza delivery money aside, you got 100, 200, 300 bucks, you can start actually investing in high yield, low risk, passive income streams in appreciating assets. And there were certain investment, call it trends, in the past few years, crypto, where people got really excited. I can get 1,000% returns in a year. But you can also get a absolute 100% loss in a short period of time in those two. I think the people we appeal to are the ones who understand that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, probably another tulip bulb bubble. But at the same time, there are ways to be more competitive, and to a medium to long-term approach, you can really build good, healthy savings and wealth in a way that isn't flying too close to the sun. So we often say inside the team, our goal is to be Daedalus, not Icarus, because Daedalus was very ambitious. He had the idea to put wax on his arms and feathers on his waxed arms and fly out of a tower over the ocean. And that's actually a pretty ambitious idea. But Icarus, unfortunately, wanted to fly even closer to the sun and show off and got a little greedy, and that didn't work out. And so it's about managing your ambition with recognizing that at a certain point, too good to be true. So we really try to appeal to that, but making a mission upfront that it's not just helping people who have very large amounts of cash, but even people who want to start earlier when they don't have a lot of savings. This is a really good option, especially with a long-term view.
And so you're helping those funds build their short-term rental portfolio. And then as an LP, I can invest in the fund knowing that it's backed by or managed by boutiques. Got it.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of three value adds we deliver. One is a better understanding of the future rental value from a revenue standpoint. Two is search and discovery. And that isn't just about like how much can earn. It's regulatory due diligence. It's environmental due diligence. So a lot of my undergrad was studying climate change and drought patterns and water access, which probably wasn't very exciting in the early 2000s for most people, but right now is obviously very important. So we really have this lens of not just what is it worth now, but what could happen. So just because you're allowed to do short-term rental doesn't mean you can tomorrow. You have to really pay attention to how the political winds are shaping up. And it's not just a legal thing. It's just a matter of like, will you be welcome or not? And also what's the serviceability? So it's really taking a sophisticated, holistic view, but also wanting to make sure that the asset is a good investment tomorrow and a great investment in 10, 20, 30 years.
And so that's one of the things when I started peeling back the onion on short-term rentals, one thing that was always a barrier for me was the regulatory landscape that an HOA, the president could change and the HOA says, hey, we're not allowing short-term rentals anymore. And then you're done, right? And then that short-term rental has to turn into a long-term rental. And typically those economics don't stack up, right? So how do you mitigate that risk to keep the ever-changing regulatory tides that are changing? How do you track that?
It's such a good call out because you have to have your eyes wide open to that potential, right? And so when I mentioned the previous areas of study, public policy was one of them. And so I love good regulation and we track all regulation. And I would say, unfortunately, a lot of what we see with short-term rentals is attempts at regulation that really stifle the opportunity for economic activity, unfortunately. And we want to be totally aware of what's happening and to only operate where it is settled. So we want it to be legal for an investor-owned short-term rental. And what's funny is I think a lot of people think that's a negative thing, but I actually see the ability to provide high quality, like housing accommodations, which is what these rentals are, in a dynamic value add way where you're employing local individuals for cleaning, for HVAC, for plumbing, for all of those things, and you're letting people travel and experience those communities. That's a good thing. That's an objectively good thing that I think a lot of people do themselves when they travel. And so I actually think it's something that should be supported. And so it's important for us when we're doing the reviews on where to buy is we're looking at regulation, we're looking at serviceability, and of course, we're looking at rental, the revenue opportunities. Right. It has to be that holistic approach for sure.
And I guess you said you're operating in 15 different locations. What, again, late or mid 2023, the world is different than it was even a year ago from an interest rate perspective and all of that, I guess. What are you seeing as far as changes in the short-term rentals market? Is now a good time to buy given the high interest rates? Like, what are you talking to investors, whether they're individuals or these funds? Like, what's your guidance?
I have a pretty strong opinion about this. I actually think it's actually a pretty good time to buy. And I'm not saying that as some sort of hype, but I would argue it might have been a worse time to buy when interest rates were super low. And the logic at a meta level is that homes that would be listed for $1 million, which is a number I think everyone can get their head around, going back 2017, you'd probably expect that you'd get that under contract for around 950. Once the pandemic rush on real estate occurred, you were seeing those homes go for definitely 1.1 million and more likely like 1.2 to 1.25 million with no inspections, all these contingencies waived.
All cash.
Yeah. I mean, it was insane. And money was cheap from a lending standpoint, but do you really want to pay a 20 to 25% premium on the list price and waive a lot of the important stopgaps you have to make sure you're not lemon, which is a thing that happened a lot. There were no punch lists being addressed by sellers. It was just take it or leave it. So this craziness was meaning you're actually really overpaying for that $1 million home. You're now paying 1.2, 1.25.
Yep.
Now you're going to see that home maybe listed for around 1 or maybe 950. But there's more softening in the negotiation. So those homes, the smart, patient investor who isn't getting emotional on this can definitely get that home for closer to 900 and sometimes closer to 800. So first thing to take into account is, do you really want to pay a 25% premium over asking versus a 10 to 20% discount just to get a cheaper rate? Because when money's cheap, there's way more people who can participate in that feeding frenzy. Secondly, is that once you've locked in the price, it doesn't mean you're actually stuck with that interest rate.
Right.
So you can easily get an adjustable rate mortgage with a 10-year lock-in, which then gives you plenty of time from when rates start to come down to, frankly, just refinance into a longer-term 30-year. But also the cash flow on these properties, if done right, can be really good. Your balance comes way down. So the final point I'd make is, even at the higher interest rate, just consider that if you had, let's call it $250,000 to put into Home X at whatever price, you still supposedly have $250,000 to put it in now. So the question is, do you want that to be paying, call it on $1 million, a quarter of the price at 25% down payment? Or now, if that's an $800,000 purchase price, that's worth way more, closer to 30% or more of the price. So now you've actually financed less. And so in the end, there's ways that you can actually see these numbers start to work in your favor. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't be paying attention. You should do the math, do the numbers, run a model out, and also know when you really do need to start thinking about, when am I going to refi? When is a good point? That said, even with rates as high as they are, there are still lenders. And if you work with your bank, especially if you have a personal banking relationship and you're not just applying through an app, you will see that there are good rates available, and it is about conversations. So part of what we do goes into that. We are not lenders. We don't partner with lenders, but we do understand the process. And one of the things we also try to get people to understand is, there are loans that you actually aren't allowed to do short-term rental, or you need special insurance, et cetera.
Oh, interesting.
So there's all this due diligence that people don't take into account. So we really, really try to give people the full view. And in the end, our mindset is to be a Sherpa, because we had to learn a lot of things the hard way, or frankly, just Google searches and lots of endless conversations.
Yeah.
When people work with us, what they're really getting is the education we bring with it. So they truly have peace of mind and way less work.
I'm curious a little bit about, if somebody has a short-term rental that's listening to this, or they're trying to get into it and maybe do it themselves, what are some of the things that you see as massive, like, areas to improve a house that are going to list it or generate more revenue? Like, is it having a killer backyard? Like, if you're buying $1 million lake property in Austin, right? Like, is it the pool? Is it, what are some of the key selling points? And it may be different for location to location, but what are things you're like, if it doesn't have this, it's definitely not going to generate as much revenue. Like, is there anything that
one of the ways that I would evaluate that is, for the types of rentals that we're talking about and the kind of nightly rates that we're interested in, the home is the destination. Like, it is in a destination area. So there's a lake, a mountain, whatever. There's something really exciting that's nearby, but the home itself isn't a place to drop bags. It is a place to gather. And so thinking about, what are those like group family activities? And so if you look at boutique listings, you're going to see fireplaces, indoor and outdoor. You're going to see a fire pit. You're going to see hot tub. You're going to see some family board games or arcade machines, that you're going to see different things that lend themselves to the home is part of the destination, right?
Got
it's
it.
Not just accommodations. And the second thing is, we believe in investing in the experience. And so if you invest in, make it nice so that you would want to go visit there, you would, I could cook a meal there. I could visit with my friends and family.
Yeah.
That is something that travelers are interested in, right? They want to make sure it's going to be a great fit for their group. And so those types of approaches, I think, can be really successful.
Yeah, I think of it as, most people don't want to pay for, especially for vacation, like, they don't want to pay travel accommodations where they're paying way more than they do for the mortgage or the rent on their primary residence. They don't want to be paying way more to stay at a home that's worse than the place that they left. They're paying for a little bit of a fantasy upgrade, of a wow experience. And so what we see really often, this is probably the first observation we had when we first started this over 10 years ago, is that I think most people were just saying, it's good enough. It's clean. Mm. This IKEA bed is totally fine.
Right.
That's not very impressive. And so now you're competing basically on price and everyone else's occupancy. So maybe you're going to get a booking, but it's going to be a race to the bottom on your margin. And you're just, people staying with you are just there to drop their bags, hope that it's clean, and then hit the town. But people pay a premium to be at a place where they've actually got cognitive dissonance about whether to spend time at the beach or stay in the home and keep hanging out. And when you can build that kind of experience where the home, as Rena says, becomes the destination, you really change the way that the pricing psychology works on the consumer side. And you also, frankly, change the kind of customer you're going to get. And so the people who are paying for wow also often, as a trend, can be much more respectful, because they're not trying to cut corners and give you a hard time about every single thing. They're more interested to have a great experience and work with you on that.
Yeah. We kind of talked a little bit about this, but I'm curious what the things you read talk about short-term rental market being saturated and everybody's trying to do it and all this stuff. Like, where do you see short-term rentals going? Not from like a rate perspective and all of that, obviously, but from more of like an industry. Is obviously you have a business in it, so you're betting on the best outcome. But like, where do you see it over the next few years? Just from a multifamily where I live in the syndication world has gone up really fast. And now it's kind of petered out a little bit this year. It's a little bit slower, but like, just high level, where do you see this market going?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing about the short-term rental industry is it's still such a small but growing segment of accommodations. And so there is so much room to grow. And so even if you think that more people than ever before own them, operate them, et cetera, even if you buy that premise, it is still such a small sliver compared to hotel. And so there's a ton of growth because it has really good stickiness. So when travelers stay at a short-term rental, and obviously we're focused on vacation rentals, when they stay, they love it. They want to come back to it. And so the fact that there are more people operating speaks to people being aware of the opportunity, but we don't yet have all of that traveler demand met with supply, and the traveler demand is growing. And so I think that's really exciting about the market. And I think just with real estate in general, like, you can try to time the market and like best of luck, but I think that the reality is people like to travel in homes, whether it's urban, whether it's leisure, they like it. That's not going to go anywhere. What we're going to see is more professionalization, consolidation, higher quality standards. And I think those things are going to be good for the industry. So I see it as it's going to keep growing. There will be ups and downs based on the overall economic environment and inflation, things like that. But it's going to get bigger and it's going to get better.
Yeah, I don't really think that good vacation rentals necessarily compete with hotels or other stay options. I think it's just a different preference, and that people are often looking for something very different based on the type of trip they're taking. So
yeah,
business trip, I love staying in a hotel. It's simple and straightforward. I don't need a lot of space. When I'm there to spend a week with people and I really want to, frankly, just decompress, I need communal space, nice big living rooms or more than one, TV areas, et cetera, and my own bedrooms. It's really about bringing people together while also giving them their own spaces, so you're not on top of each other. Anybody who's stayed in a hotel room with one or two kids as well certainly knows what it's like to wish you had a more room.
Yeah.
The other thing is, there's often a knock on the industry that certain lobbying groups like, oh, it takes away jobs. And I really beg to differ. I think that actually it creates much better jobs. People who are working minimum wage as a housekeeper in a hotel can now, frankly, independently earn way more money. On the other side, the owner operators are, frankly, much more decent and respectful to the people that do some of these services. And if you really understand how hard it is to do it well, and that this is hard work physically, but it's also a bit mentally complex in ways that people don't necessarily take into account. If you really treat people with respect, and I'm not just talking about your personal interactions, but frankly, compensate them very well, you can actually earn way more money and have way more peace of mind and less stress as the owner operator, because you're no longer dealing with a case of constantly nickel and diming and having inconsistent quality. And so in the end, I think that a rising tide lifts all boats. And rather than taking a mindset of what do I think I can take you for, or what would you be willing to do, what's the lowest price you'll go, what is a price that motivates you to do a great job is also something that will then frankly be reflected in the prices you can charge your guests, because they also want that peace of mind.
Yeah, just a quick story about your point about traveling for business is fine for a hotel, but traveling and meeting family, like Airbnb is like the way to go. My dad's sister and I are meeting in Dallas for a Cowboys game later this year, and we were going to all stay in the same hotel in different rooms. And it's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And I was like, oh, we should try to find an Airbnb. There's an Airbnb within walking distance. There's dozens of them within walking distance of Cowboy Stadium. So that's what we're going to do. And it has a big yard. Everybody has their own bathroom, bedroom. So I'm sure it'll be lovely. But it's like, it would have been so kind of not a family event to stay in three separate hotel rooms. Now it's going to be like, oh, we're all waking up and having coffee in the morning, you know, all that fun stuff.
That's it. It's like the shared meals. It's watching the movie together. It's like staying up late playing cards or whatever. It's
right,
like
exactly.
The shared experiences, you just can't beat it. It's so cool.
The other way to put it is, you need an environment that fosters serendipity in terms of interaction. People talk about the water cooler effects of being in an office together, but it's also the serendipity of being among family and friends that, if you disappear down the hall and close your door, the odds of, frankly, like having good random conversations and hanging out or being inspired to watch a movie together doesn't really happen.
Yeah. Totally. I want to wrap this up here in a few minutes, but I want to get a quick dynamic of husband and wife working together in the same business in this. I don't know if you have a physical office space or not, if you guys are just working at home out of your own respective bedroom / offices, but how do you guys also divide up the business responsibilities? Because obviously toes can be stepped on and all that fun stuff, and you still have to eat dinner together later. So
she's in charge and I do what she says.
That's fair.
And that's like business. That's not personal life. Like,
I will be upfront. I actually really wanted her to run the show. There was never any debate here. I'm not even sure if she was going to ask for that, but I really trust her more than I trust myself. I think we have really good instincts about swim lanes. So I'm sharing that upfront mm-hmm. so she doesn't have to say it. But the reality is some people's personalities are well suited to certain roles. And there are moments that are very, very tough. The margin of error is slim in terms of what you can afford to get wrong. And the signal is not necessarily very clear. And I just think that Rena is one of the best people I've ever known to make those decisions, both at work and then frankly at home. So 24/7 boss, basically. And I just do what she tells me.
Because people, of course, have asked us about this. And I think early on, people were like, ooh, that's a risk. Like, as like, we know each other. We've been together, it'll be 17 years in October. Yeah. We actually truly know each other. We'd started a soccer nonprofit together back in DC. We've helped each other with startups. We always help each other, even with different professional jobs. Like, hey, can you read this? Hey, what do you think about that? And now it's like our powers combine. Like, we get to work together and we are better together. We are bluntly, and our strengths are different. And we also respect each other's strengths. And so I actually think we have a very strong working relationship, which is very cool. And yeah, I would say the lines between personal life and business life are super blurry because especially because it's a startup, as co-founders, we kind of eat, sleep, breathe it. So I would say that's obviously a little bit of a downside, but also we made that choice. We know what we're doing, but I wouldn't want to work with anybody but him on these things. And I trust him 100%. I know he's never going to be like looking for a different job or something. Like,
that's right.
I know he's bought in.
My wife, Allison, and I, when we started our real estate business, it was very tough to have that break of, we had our day jobs. I was running a recruiting business. She had her W-2. And then we would like sit down and watch TV / dinner / let's talk about real estate. So it was always this like dynamic of like, okay, when do we actually just talk about stuff that's not either work or business related? And it's just us and our two cats, so they don't care what we talk about. But you know, so it's like, for us, it's like, okay, well, it doesn't matter. We can talk about work and business all while still having a great relationship and all that fun stuff. So I see a lot of parallels in that. And I also agree that if my wife was ever to start a business or want to join our business full time, she would definitely be the boss and she's way smarter than I am. So I would definitely follow her direction for sure.
Sounds like it'd be very successful.
100%. I think it's interesting what you just said, because we actually had this a few times where it's kind of like, pause, this thing we're discussing that we may not be of the same mind on, is this a work or a personal conversation? We actually put, like, we'll literally like pause, decide what it is, and then I know whether I should be comfortable pushing back a bit more if it's a personal conversation relative to the family versus work, because it is blurred. I think that early on, one of the things that was scary, but we had to give it a shot, was we are all in. So the wins and the losses, you are the highs, the lows, you're feeling at the same time. There's no balance in that. But what has been a bit surprising, I think we were just talking about the other day, is when one of us is feeling beaten up, we do just find that naturally the other one is always for some reason like ready to go and just like pick the other one up and get after it. Like for some reason, we balance each other very well in that energy.
Yeah.
And that maybe is something that any couple looking forward should know. If you're both going to be down at the same time, that can be rough. But if you know how to, like, at home, that one of you is feeling a little bit like, this isn't working, or I'm frustrated, like, and the other one is ready. Look, I got an optimistic view. I know how to fix this. We're going to take care of it. If you have that dynamic, it's much easier. I will say that the math shows that there's a lot of studies by groups like the Kaufman Fellows and other that show that first, female CEOs are more likely to succeed and less likely to lose everybody's money. And that's not something most people take into account when they make investments.
Yeah, they're more fiscally responsible.
3% of VC dollars going to female CEOs, you know, it's kind of absurd, because the odds are that that money would actually, frankly, be better invested with women if you're just going on the math. But number two, it turns out that married co-founders is the same thing. And maybe it is just the dynamic of, I can't afford to lose, so I'm not going to mess this up. But the math is there. It's still up to people to decide. And I think some people are very interested in the idea of investing in a married couple because they think it can work better. And there's other people who might be a little turned off by it. And we usually find that out pretty quickly.
Yeah. No, I think it's great. I think if more people had that relationship, that dynamic, it definitely could be beneficial for a lot of reasons. But I could dig even deeper into a lot of things, but I want to be respectful of time and everything. So I've got a 3-pack of questions that I ask every guest. So it'd be interesting if your answers will be the same on the last one. But what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey or business creation journey?
Nothing venture, nothing gain.
That's fair.
I would say just the getting over the idea that it's meant for somebody else. Like, I remember when I was younger, my dad was like, oh, Rena, you could buy a home. And I like grew up in Idaho. I was like, Dad, I can't buy a home. Like, we don't come from money. Like, I don't buy a home. Like, that's not something that's for me. And then when we started to get into it and people were like, yeah, you can do this. And there are ways to make it affordable. And just like breaking down that barrier, that was the biggest thing, is feeling like, no, real estate is for people who already have money. And being like, no, it is a way for people to make money. And that's, everybody can be part of that group. That's the thing I would say the biggest for me.
No, that's awesome. I've got a quote on my desk. It's like, why not me? Like, there's always like, it doesn't matter where you came from. I grew up in a real small town. Like, it's, you can do whatever you want to do kind of a thing. That's so
right. If you think you can do it or you think you can't, you're probably right. That ability to envision the outcome you want and then maintain that as the North Star that you draw yourself towards is real. I think if you really can't see how this works, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. All right, what's your favorite business or real estate book that you're into right now? You said you read a lot, so I'm sure you've got a lot of books.
It's funny, to be honest, we have two young kids. I like don't read books right now. I've read a lot of books, but I read like articles. I feel like it's articles and podcasts and things that are more easily digestible, or you can like listen to it while you're doing something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my daily routine is I'm pretty religious about combing through my Apple News and Google News feeds, the New York Times. I'm always looking for the obscure feature story, the longer form. I really like, frankly, being able to listen now, kind of like a book on tape. You can listen to long form articles. That can be really great. Marketplace is definitely my daily diet on the NPR show.
Yeah.
I would say that I still go back to certain books like Let My People Go Surfing by Yvon Chouinard, who's the Patagonia founder.
Oh, yeah.
Bernie Brenner, who it was a real moment of pride and validation when he actually became one of our investors. He wrote a phenomenal book that I cannot stop recommending to everybody, which is The Sumo Advantage. It really teaches you about when you're small, how to find big partners and make it a symbiotic relationship that's mutually beneficial. And then finally, I think the Techstars, Austin MD, Amy Schwartzfarb has written some really good books about sales. And I think that if you're like us and you don't have a sales background, really learning that and understanding it's a discipline, it's something that I think people should, but often don't put as much, I would say, technique and effort into and intellectual thought into as they do, say, programming or other pursuits. I think that those books that often are for the comfort zones that you lack are some of the best. So whatever you think you should be good at, but you're not currently, but you think you could learn, that's where I lean in.
Got it. All right. This is going to be an interesting one. So if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of passive income from real estate, what would you do?
Ooh, yes, I love that. And I feel like we're going to be doing it. Like, this is in our future. Both of us are very passionate about youth and education. Mm-hmm. So I think we would be spending some time. We'd done this previous soccer nonprofit that I mentioned earlier. So we would be doing stuff with youth. And I know that's something that I would love to do. And so the goal is like, let's build something really special that we want to exist out in the world. But then let's also have some free time that we can do special things like that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty important to us. Like, I don't have any interest in living on a yacht or any lifestyle like that. I'm actually pretty keen simply to, I very much expect that I will probably work right through to the end, but I want it to be that it's my choice to do these things and not that I feel stuck.
Yep.
And so that was a big reason we started the business, frankly, was that we saw a path, if you can envision it, that before our kids were 10 years old, we could have certain financial security that would then allow us to both spend time with them on our terms. So the opportunity to walk them to school and pick them up from school is something we've really, really wanted. To dip out at 3 o'clock to go coach soccer practice. But I think that, as Rena said, working with youth, whether it's, I think I've often figured I'd go back to coaching high school soccer and maybe a guidance counselor, but I'd also really like to teach entrepreneurship at younger and younger ages. Fiscal financial education, I think, is not very common and very rare in communities where it's needed most. I really like to find ways to inspire people who are often not in financially privileged environments or households to find that personal strength and independence, but also knowledge. And frankly, the most important thing is plugging them into networks. So currently, Rena and I do a bunch of volunteering with organizations like Techstars, and in particular, certain groups like in Tulsa and Detroit, where the managing directors have really made an effort to ensure that people who might not have these unique networks that can help them take a business to an IPO or a unicorn level, that they can plug in and be exposed to those relationships. And I think that's something I'd love to be a part of.
I'll distill it real quick that I would say throughout our careers and just personally, we like to be focusing on increasing opportunity and access. And we also have this like restlessness and this desire to build and like a bias towards action. And so that would continue whatever happens.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate you guys being on the podcast. How can people find you and what's the best way to connect?
Yeah. So it's boutique.co is our website. You can see the homes. You can send us a message there. We're also at boutique on pretty much all social handles, and we are responsive. So if people want to reach out to talk shop or to think about becoming involved or be a traveler, we are really happy to have that conversation and would very much welcome it.
And that's boutique spelled B-O-U-T-I-Q. Because it's a startup, it cannot have a normal spelling, of course.
That's right. We will make sure that it is spelled correctly in the show notes so everybody can just click a link and make it super easy. So
I can assure you, if you send a message to hello@boutique, I get every one of those emails and I read every single one and will respond.
Got it. Challenge accepted. All right. So appreciate you guys being on the podcast. It's good to catch up. And yeah, we'll talk soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Justin.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.